Where I'd like you to start, unless you can think of anything relevant that sort of occurred before, was when you were at Smith Kline French. Mm-hmm. If you could fill in a little bit more of that history, in particular, how you would characterize the relationship of the pharmaceutical industry to academia at that time and the kind of work that you were doing there.
Well, a little known fact is that prior to the Second World War, drug testing for its possible therapeutic efficacy was done exclusively in academia. There were no scientists in the industry, per se. And after the Second World War, several people from academics were hired by Smith Kline and French to actually form an internal research group. I went there in a very strange circumstance. They had given a one-year contract to a psychologist by the name of Don Bullock, who was a polio victim. He was paralyzed from the waist on down. He worked in a wheelchair. And I was hired as his assistant. And Don was a very brilliant person, but he was also very outspoken, and he became very critical of our mutual boss in front of his boss, and that was something you did not do in industry. And he was asked to leave after 6 months, and I thought, well, I guess they're going to close down the lab. And E.J. Fellows, the director of biological sciences, came in and said, well, why aren't you working? Why aren't things running? And I said, well, you know, Dr. Bullock is gone. He said, well, you're in charge. And so there I was with a master's degree. And I said, okay. So I continued running the experimental psychopharmacology laboratory. And I had two consultants, Charlie Furster, who was one of Skinner's colleagues. He wrote the book Furster and Skinner. And another person, a psychiatrist by the name of Carl Prebram. And so I had, you know, great outside support, but I just was stumbling my way along, as was the whole field at that time, because we really didn't know that much about behavior and drugs. And I was fortunate enough to be there and get a good start. Board of directors of Smith, Kline & French met, and we were about to order a huge amount of equipment to increase the laboratory space. And they said, well, who's in charge of it? And they said, well, this guy is Schuster. And they said, oh, Dr. Schuster. And they said, no, he didn't have a doctorate. We've got to find somebody with a, you know, with a doctorate. So Roger Kelleher came in to take it over, and I went back to graduate school to get my doctorate.
Thank you. Very nice. You, in the addiction interview, you described the dominance of psychoanalytic explanations, and you contrasted your work with that. Can you tell me how dominant psychoanalysis was at that point, what you knew about it, and why you saw yourself in contrast to it at that point?
Well, first of all, one of the things that is interesting is that Smith, Kline & French, when they first were going to put chlorpromazine, better known as Thorazine, onto the market for the treatment of schizophrenia, spent a year getting the opinion makers in psychiatry to accept the fact that a medication might be useful for a psychiatric disorder, because psychoanalytic theories were so predominant, and psychoanalysis and pharmacotherapy were judged to be incompatible by many psychoanalysts. So, for example, if one had anxiety, the anxiety was necessary for the person to work through their whatever the psychic conflicts were that were causing the anxiety. And to alleviate that with a pharmacotherapy would have been unacceptable to psychoanalysts. So, psychoanalytic theory was absolutely, that was psychiatry at that time. There was no biological psychiatry, really, until the revolution really occurred when chlorpromazine was introduced as a treatment for schizophrenia. In the area of the addictions, excuse me, in the area of the addictions, there was some research going on and some contrary thinking by people like Abraham Wickler and Bill Martin and the people at Lexington, United States Public Health Service Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, which was where federal prisoners were treated for opiate addiction and other addictions. But in the field in general across the United States, the only people who thought about addiction were psychiatrists, and they were all psychoanalysts. So it was the idea, I mean, that I expressed in the article of the resolution of latent homosexuality. It was just, you know, that was a very commonly accepted theory, and it just didn't fit with the facts as I knew them, having grown up as a jazz musician and knowing the people that I did who had become involved with heroin and got addicted to it. It just didn't please me as an explanation. It didn't seem feasible. And then, of course, when we got into the monkey work, it completely revolutionized things, because the idea that drugs could serve as positive reinforcers in the same way that food and sex and water did in animals deprived of those commodities was just revolutionary, because it then meant we could, all the information and all the things that we knew from studies of food reinforcement in the laboratory, we could see, hey, do drugs work the same way? And by and large, I think the answer to that is yes. And we still continue to view drugs as reinforcers. And I think probably the most effective therapies that we have, including cognitive behavioral therapy, contingency management, et cetera, are based upon behavior analytic principles that have at their base the fact that drugs serve as reinforcers. Yeah. It was surprising, but now we know so much more about the brain and the systems that are there to mediate the effects of all positive reinforcers, whether it's food, drug, or sex. And we simply have drugs that short circuit can get there directly.
Yes, right, indeed. Could you talk about when you think you became aware of the work at Lexington?
Actually, it's interesting. I think that probably after I went back to graduate school. I did not know about it before I went back to graduate school. Abraham Wickler was probably the person who most influenced my thinking at that time, because although he was not really a behaviorist in the traditional sense, he was very, very interested in the phenomenon of Pavlovian conditioning. When people went to Lexington, they would be there for several years, and unlike many of our jails and prisons today, there were no drugs in Lexington. It is like Fort Knox. I mean, it nothing gets in and out that is not controlled. And yet, when people were there for several years and were discharged, a guy by the name of George Valiant found that when they went back to their home environment, a huge percentage, maybe up to 90%, relapsed within a five-year period. And Abraham Wickler saw some of the people who relapsed, and they described that when they went back to their home environment, they oftentimes felt again like they were going into withdrawal. And that made them crave opiates, and they went on to relapse to heroin use. So he hypothesized that the environmental stimuli that had in the past been associated with their drug use had, in a Pavlovian conditioning way, came to elicit withdrawal. And he actually did some studies in rats in which he paired an environment with withdrawal, and then when they were not in withdrawal, put them into that environment, and they showed characteristic signs of withdrawal. I did a similar study with Steve Goldberg a few years later, after I got my doctorate, and but it was all based upon Abraham Wickler's theories of persons, places, and things stimulating through Pavlovian conditioning, conditioned withdrawal, and that led to relapse to drug use.
Can you tell me more about Wickler? Well, do you still consider those studies good studies today?
Well, I think that those studies were absolutely seminal in the sense of orienting people towards a looking at how the environment could control behavior and how it could influence behavior and in regard to the addictions. He was an amazing person. He was a psychiatrist. He was also a good pharmacologist with excellent training in pharmacology, but because of his training as a psychiatrist, he had not really bought into the psychoanalytic framework of addiction. He had somehow or other, and I don't know how, become enamored with classical conditioning and learning theory and use that as his framework, which was extraordinary for the time.
What about Lawrence Cobb and his shadow? Didn't Wickler have to do something to kind of reconcile Cobb and psychopathology with his own views?
Well, I don't think that he would have argued at all against the idea that there were that psychopathology was that I guess the psychopathology that he would have talked about would have been the comorbid psychiatric problems that existed in most of these people, whether it was antisocial personality disorder, whether it was, you know, many of them suffer from depression, and he was quite aware of the fact that they had other psychiatric problems. But I think that he, rather than looking at it as psychopathology, addiction per se, he looked at it as a behavioral manifestation that was understandable using the principles of classical conditioning and learning theory.
Great. What about Isbell? Did you have contact with him?
Not as much, but he was, I guess I would say that Harris Isbell was one of the major people that would come be at the College on Problems of Drug Dependence meetings, and we would all attend all of his talks. I think Harris Isbell, I looked at more as a clinical investigator who did very interesting pharmacological studies, and followed by, of course, Bill Martin and then Don Jasinski and sort of that lineage. And he certainly did, I mean, you know, some of the classic studies, and I mean, for example, he working with Conan Kurnesky, as I remember it, was the first to establish the physical dependence on barbiturates and show withdrawal from those and so forth. So he was very active in the area of pharmacological investigations in humans, which was very exciting.
Yeah. So in other words, you were well aware of that group long before you headed NIDA and had to deal with it as an intramural
program. Right.
Okay, that's great. Now let's talk about behavioral pharmacology and how you see, could you tell me how you think behavioral pharmacology emerged as a cohesive field?
Well, it's interesting. I'm writing a history right now of behavioral pharmacology for a textbook that's going to be translated into Russian, so I won't read it. It's interesting. There was a coalescence of two things. Number one, there were people like Peter V. Dews, who was trained as a classical pharmacologist, and in classical pharmacology at that time, he used to do studies in things like isolated guinea pig ileum, and you'd take out the guinea pig's ileum and you'd put it, stretch it out and hook it up and electrically stimulate it, and it would contract, and it would be in a bath. So, and you could add drugs to the bath, and see what happened to the size of the contractions or their frequency. And it was all came out nicely charted. And then you could wash that dose of the drug out and let it recover and then put another dose in. And so having a reliable baseline against which you could give different doses of a drug was absolutely essential. Well, Peter went to Harvard and he ran into students of B.F. Skinner who were putting pigeons into a box every day, and every day the behavior looked the same unless they changed the conditions. And he looked at this and he thought, gee, this would make a useful baseline in which I could look at the behavioral effects of drugs. And he began to study that. So there was this marvelous interface between this classical pharmacologist who saw the opportunity because of the work of Skinner to be able to do this. And because of that, that's why the gentleman that I worked for at SmithKline & French got involved. I mean, he heard about Peter Dews and Bill Morris and the guys at Harvard who were doing these kinds of studies and said, well, gee, you know, like I'm trained as a behavior analyst. I can do drug studies too. So he proposed to SmithKline & French that he come in and set up various behavioral procedures to screen for new medications for different kinds of psychiatric disorders. So I think it was just behavior analysis was emerging as a dominant influence in the field. It was very compatible with pharmacology. Unlike people who were studying learning, which is sort of a one-shot affair, behavior analysts were studying stable behavior and how you could, if you change the conditions, it would change. And so you could, it just was a perfect marriage.
Mm-hmm. And when you went back to grad school, came into the field, can you tell me who, well, obviously Joe Brady was an influence on you at that point?
Well, there were a number of people. Joe Brady was, at that time, Joe was in the Army, and he was in the Army for 25 years or more. He was stationed at Walter Reed, and there were an incredible number of psychologists who would be drafted, and he would arrange for them to come to Walter Reed to join the research unit there. So there were people like Richard Herrnstein, who wrote The Bell Curve, very famous psychologist who is now dead. But he was at the University of Maryland when I was there, although he was in the Army. He was sent over there by Joe Brady because he and Mary Sidman, who was at Walter Reed, they had some friction. And so Dick Herrnstein, despite the fact he was technically stationed at Walter Reed, spent all of his time over at the University of Maryland, which is where I was, mm-hmm. and where Joe had a part, was also a professor. There were many people there. Murray Sidman was a huge influence on all of us. There were also, in addition to the psychologists there were incredible scientists that worked with Joe in the Division of Psychiatry, which was under the direction of Dave Riach, who was a marvelous man, a psychiatrist who was in charge of the whole thing. But Robert Galambos, who was the guy who found out how bats navigate in the dark with sonar. Wally Nauta, the very famous neuroanatomist. Mason, who was a neuroendocrinologist, all of these people were there, and all of them taught for Joe at the University of Maryland. So I had the privilege of having all of these marvelous people who were not really at the University of Maryland. They were at Walter Reed, but they came over and gave lectures. So I studied anatomy with Wally Nauta, who, you know, he was amazing. He was an artist. He would stand at the board and draw brain structures with both hands at the same time. I mean, it was awesome, absolutely awesome.
I mean, you have to wonder what was going on in his brain.
In his brain. I can't imagine how anybody could do that. You know, but he did.
So at what point did you start thinking about addiction?
Well, that was because of Jim Mason. Jim Mason was a neuroendocrinologist who was interested in studying stress and how were you going to get blood out of a monkey's body without stressing them. Well, one way was that he surgically implanted a catheter into the jugular vein, ran it up subcutaneously to the top of the head, mounted a little pedestal up there, and when he wanted to get blood out, he could connect up to that pedestal a line, and the animal was sitting in a chair and could not get to the catheter that came out, and he could stay in the other room, and through this long catheter that hooked up to the one that went down into his vein, he could take blood out whenever he wanted to. Well, I looked at that and I thought, well, if he can take blood out, I can put things in. And being trained as a behavior analyst, and I was not going to just put them in, I thought, well, I wonder whether or not animals would work, would perform an operant task such as lever press in order to get something put in. And I flashed back to my days as a jazz musician and thought about all the drugs that people self-injected. And I thought, at first, I'm going to have to do something very tricky to get healthy-minded rhesus monkeys to take a drug. Mm-hmm. But I didn't.
And back to the jazz musician thing, where were you at the time that you were observing this?
Well, I grew up in Camden, New Jersey, and started playing trumpet when I was 5. My mother was a musician and an incredible singer. My sister, who was 7 years older than I am, was very interested in jazz. And she was a poet and hung out in the nightclubs in Philadelphia and got to know a lot of the jazz musicians. And so on Saturdays, she had what we call the 1020 Club. We lived at 1020 Broadway in Camden, New Jersey. And whoever was in town from the big bands or whatever would come over in the afternoon. And, you know, we had food and drink. And my sister was very beautiful. And so they would come over and they would play because we had a big grand piano because my mother was a musician. And so I would hang around there. And, you know, I had my cornet when I was real little and my trumpet later. And they'd say, come on, play with us, you know. So I was very blessed to, you know, play with a lot of sort of big-name people in my house.
And this was what era?
This would have been 1943, 44. And it was the war, Second World War, and so every bar had live entertainment. Everybody, because we come out of the Depression, and people were making money because of the war, and so Friday and Saturday nights I would play in local bars with a quartet. None of us could drive, but my father had always been very supportive of my mother as a musician, and when we didn't have a job on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, we'd get in his car, and he would drive us around, and we'd drop into the various clubs, and we'd set up, and we'd play a little and say, hey, do you want to hire us for the weekend? And that's how we got jobs.
That's wonderful. Did you, rumor has it that there wasn't a lot of heroin on the streets during the Second World War? What were you seeing?
Well, it was actually towards the end of that time, in about 47, that I saw a very, very good friend, Riz Rodney, who was played with Charlie Parker, and he was a local Philadelphia musician. He was 2 years older than I was, and he knew my sister, and I used to go over every day, not every day, two or three times a week, I would go over to the WCAU studios in Philadelphia where a big band playing live in the afternoon, and Red was the featured soloist with them. And I hung out with him, and he started to use heroin at that point and remained addicted for the next 30 years. And a very tragic But fortunately, before the end of his life, Ira Flanagan helped him, another musician, and he overcame. He stopped using heroin, got much heavier, and played very well until he died.
And you remained friends?
We remained acquaintances. I will be honest and say that when Red was addicted to heroin, he did some things that I heartily disapproved of. He encouraged other people who were trying to stop using heroin to continue on with him. And I had some who were desperately trying to quit, and he kept enticing them back into it. And so we were not friends at that point.
So. Yes.
I will be very honest. I watched Red and others of his friends shoot up heroin.
You weren't tempted?
I will be very, very candid. There were two aspects to it. Yes, at that period of time, I smoked marijuana. Jazz musicians did that. And I thought, gee, if I'm a jazz musician, that's part of the game. Sometimes with devastating consequences, because one of the first times I ever smoked marijuana, it distorts your time sense so much. I was playing with a big band. I got up to take a solo, and I played about six notes, and I thought I'd played too long and sat down. And my friend, who was in the saxophone section, realizing why I had this time perception problem, started laughing and honking into his saxophone. And both of us, we got fired. I've often said, and there's some truth to it, I was too neurotic at that point in my life to think about putting a needle into my arm. It was just, no.
Yeah.
I suffered from panic disorder as an adolescent and a young adult, and so I was too anxious to, and fortunately never experimented with it, because of course opiates are very good anxiolytics. Mm-hmm. There's no question that I was at risk.
At what point did you leave that scene? How long were you associated?
Well, throughout high school, I played pretty much 2 to 3 nights a week professionally, and continued to do that in the first couple year or two of my college career, because I couldn't get into a regular college.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I had to go to a community college, and when I went to New Mexico in my junior year, I tried to play out there. There was not much work for jazz in Albuquerque at that time. There were a few good jazz players there, and they dominated the field. And the second thing was that Albuquerque was segregated. I went into the Hilton Hotel to play with a mixed group for a fraternity dance, and within 30 minutes the police came and threw us out. It would have been okay if it had been an all-black band, but a mixed band was not allowed. And so I got pretty incensed and spent the better part of my time out there working on an anti-segregation ordinance, which was ultimately passed. There were several members of the Communist Party who were extremely active in that effort, and because of my association with them through this, I was probably declared a security risk, because I enlisted in the Air Force and they never called me up. I sat and waited. That was a few years later, but I admit it. I was always quite candid about the fact that that, you know, I knew these people, I went to parties at their home, et cetera. But my interest was in the anti-segregation ordinance, and, you know.
Can I just ask, did these facts come to light when you were nominated for the directorship?
Yes, absolutely. I was totally candid with the FBI when they talked to me about this. I said, you know, I have no idea. I've never gotten my federal dossier but I enlisted in the Air Force and I was never called up. And my uncle, who was a general in the Army, implied, although he never stated it absolutely, that it was because they were afraid in the McCarthy era that I would be another number for him. And I was completely candid about all of this. And what I was told was that they understood that during the McCarthy era, many people were subjected to this type of thing, and that they did not think it was that important.
Very interesting. All right. I think we're now back to grad school. We're going slowly, but this is wonderful to hear. And I realize that you've got about...
Oh, I can, you know, by the way, I can come back.
You can?
Yeah, I can come back if later.
Would you like
morning.
To go on about Philadelphia? I wrote a dissertation about the 1950s, drugs in the 1950s.
I see.
And there were hearings in Philadelphia, the Daniel hearings, and a number of people who you might have known. This was mid-50s, though. So when did you go to Mexico?
I was in New Mexico I went there for my junior year of college because of the fact that the city was segregated. I hung out in a place called the Chicken Shack, which was on South 4th Street, which was one of the few places in town where blacks could go to eat. And there was a large number of black men in the Air Force, at Kirtland Air Force Base. And I met a man by the name of, his name is irrelevant. He was a really lovely person who I got to know very well. He also sold marijuana. He was in the Air Force. And a week before he was to bring his family out to meet me and my other white friend, Fred Foreman, who came with me nightly there, he was bringing his family out because he said they've never known a white person on a friendly basis. And he was arrested and sold marijuana to an undercover agent, and so he was arrested. Well, when he got arrested, I was stopped many, many times because it had been observed that I would drive him back to Kirtland Air Force Base in a car that I had, and so obviously I was suspect too. So I decided New Mexico was not a safe place for me to go back for my senior year of college. So
which would have been what year?
1950.
Yeah.
So I transferred to Gettysburg College.
In Pennsylvania,
and got my degree there. I enlisted in the Marine Corps because my brother-in-law had been in the Marine Corps, and I worshipped him, and I thought, gee, I got to do this. And I, at that time, you could go in directly as an officer, or directly into OCS training. And I went and I took my physical, and I was fine. And then I came back, and they said, oh, we didn't do a dental exam. And I said, okay. And they did the dental exam, and I was missing a molar on one side. And they said, sorry, Marine Corps officers have to be physically perfect. They have to have all of their own teeth and 20/20 vision. You can enlist as an, you can go in as an enlisted man. And I said, no way. And so I was not in the Marine Corps. I was subject to the draft. And I said, uh-oh. I called New Mexico, and I said, you have a graduate student. They said, this, like 2 weeks before school, I said, look, I'm coming out to graduate school. If you don't like me after I get there, you know, you can throw me out. But and so George Maxwell Peterson, the chairman of the department, let me come out, and I went out and got a master's degree there, and very good training. But and that's when it was during the second stay out there that that we got the anti-segregation ordinance passed, working with CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, and so forth. But the first time, well, it just, as I say, I just didn't feel, the police just could not understand why I would go to this place on South 4th Street if it wasn't for drugs. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't for drugs. It was because there was good music there and so forth, but, you know, they couldn't believe that.
Yes, yes. So this is wonderful.
By the way, in Philadelphia, when Billie Holiday would come into town, mm-hmm. It was a well-known fact that Philadelphia was very hot under the collar about drugs. I know because Charles Roisman, who was the Philadelphia lawyer, he was written up all the time in the Inquirer. He was the jazz musician's lawyer. He would invariably be called up because the minute Billy would get into town, she'd check into a hotel room, and 5 minutes later, they'd burst into the hotel room, and up in the ceiling, in the, you know, behind a lamp, etc., they would find some stuff. And not that they would arrest her, but they just didn't want her in town. And that was the other thing that got me out of the music business, and that is that I was always underage, so I always had false ID, so so I could play in clubs. And not making me 21, but you had to be above a certain age in order not to have, you had to have special permit to work in nightclubs. And since I worked in many different ones and you had to have it for each other, I had false ID, that's all. But I saw that the police didn't have much regard for jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. And I was frightened that I just couldn't see myself at the age of 40 being subject to being pushed around by them. And I was always frightened that, because I went to a lot of black nightclubs, and again, it's like, well, you know that Philadelphia was segregated at that mm-hmm. time. I mean, I went to a segregated school as a child.
Where did you go?
Camden, New Jersey. Yeah, yeah. Black kids went to school either 15 minutes before or 15 minutes after we did, so we wouldn't be on the street at the same time in separate schools.
I didn't know that.
Yep. But I also recently realized my grammar school, up until the sixth grade, was also segregated sexually.
Huh.
It was all boys and all girls. We were they only put us together in adolescence. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Should be the reverse.
Yeah, I think so. Yes. Exactly. But I know I'm carrying on here.
This is it's great to have your reflections about this period. We have so little on it. So. Do you want a break and then come back?
Yeah, I think
when
that's
when could you come back?
Well, hang on just 1 second. Let me just check here. I can come back at 10.
Great. Let's see. I have